Hello and welcome to this edition of Human Progress Podcast. And with me today, I have John Moynihan, Baron Moynihan of Chelsea, who is a British businessman, venture capitalist, life peer, which means that he's a member of the House of Lords, and perhaps most importantly, an author of a brand new book called Return to Growth, How to Fix the Economy. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Marion. It's great to be here.
So I suppose we should start by asking growth. Why is growth important? What does it mean and why is it important?
Yes, great question. And in fact, it was that book started out as just a small pamphlet about why growth is important. And when I submitted it to the think tank that I had agreed to do it for, they said, yes, but you've missed this and that and the other. And gradually it grew to be a 450-page book that went way beyond why it was important. But where I started was, I said there are practical reasons why growth is crucial, but there are also moral reasons why growth is crucial. The practical ones are that the world stagnates if you don't have growth. And you know, there are a couple of billion people for whom a great deal of economic growth is needed to bring them out of poverty around the world. The moral reasons are, for example, that if there's no growth, and you, Marion, are thinking, okay, for whatever reason, you want to earn more money next year, or you want a bigger house, or you want to give some money to somebody, so you need to earn some more, you want to give some money to some charity or whatever. If you're going to get more and there's no growth, then somebody else has got less. So a desire, which is very natural in the human condition, to want to better yourself, to strive, to achieve, to accomplish, to have lived a life that did things, that desire is, in a no-growth world, always going to be at the expense of somebody else. And of course, you can extend that to saying, in a no-growth world, even if we in the United States or the United Kingdom don't grow, but that also means that nobody's growing anywhere in those poorer parts of the world. So that's the moral basis for why. Now, example I like to give about the importance of growth is I base it on Alexander Fleming. These numbers are sort of very rough, so you don't. I don't want anybody writing to me saying that I got the decimal place wrong or whatever. But 112 billion human beings have lived since the beginning of human existence, 6 million years ago, whatever it was, and that's the estimate. 104 billion of them have died, and there are 8 billion of us left. By the way, every human being has the opportunity and the right to happiness, so that the more you grow, the more happiness you create around the world. But let's just look at those 104 billion who died. 80 billion or so, they say, died of infection. That was what killed human beings in the past. And those 80 billion had an average lifespan of about 30 years. So I always invite audiences to think, well, what would your life have been like if you had died at 30? How much would you have accomplished? You know, how happy are you at the thought of only living to 30 as opposed to whatever life you are now? And I had a talk I gave a couple of days ago. Some chap in the audience said, well, these two sons of mine on either side, they wouldn't have been born. But in general, let's just flip to Alexander Fleming before we get back to being age 30, but when you die. He discovered how to cultivate penicillin. And there was this whole process that led up to what then happened. What then happened was that capital and capitalism figured out how to manufacture that process in bulk and spread rapidly around the world, giving an enormous change in transformation of the human existence. So now you or I can expect to live till we're about 93. If when we were born, looking back, we had a chance of living till about 82, but we survived. We survived our potential of childhood mortality. So now we'll live till we're about 93. And that was all because infection has fundamentally been conquered as that prime cause of human death. People still get sepsis, lots of problems with that, but it's way, way below being the major cause of death. And that's economic growth. People think of economic growth as some dry set of numbers. Well, it's not. It's Alexander Fleming discovering how to cultivate penicillin and the capitalist process, learning how to spread that out around the world and having the capital to do so. And there's a whole backstory to that, which Matt Ridley, I think, is writing a book about right now, or at least it'll be part of his book, which is you've got the Renaissance in Italy, that moves to the Enlightenment in Scotland, where they start questioning everything. And that leads to the Scientific Revolution in London, where they start changing that questioning into understanding scientific laws. And that leads to the Industrial Revolution, basically in the Midlands and the north of England, places like Manchester and Birmingham, which then starts transferring over to the United States, who then really put some turbochargers under that whole process. And so we in the EU, in Britain, as we call it then, are the most powerful and rich nation in the world. And gradually that transfers to the US over the 19th century. And there's a whole backstory behind that, which is that at the bottom of all of that is a bunch of inventions regarding power. So Arkwright invented the water frame, if you've even heard of that. I'm sure you have. But so he's using water power from windmills to power his frame to make cloth with. And then that moves to the spinning jenny that starts using steam power. And that moves on. You're bit by bit, you're getting better and better at creating cheap energy. And you move to coal, and then to oil, and somewhere along that road, you learn how to turn that into electricity, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper to power this industrial revolution that leads to all sorts of economic growth that leads to a massive transformation of the human existence over 200 years. The life extension being a classic and key component of that. But, you know, so I say to people, well, you know, you say you don't want economic growth. Well, how would you like to only live to 30 instead of your expectation of 93? And by the way, the chief cause of death nowadays is inflammation it's the over-inflammation mostly, that the inflammatory response goes slightly crazy and you get cancer or heart disease or Alzheimer's or all sorts of inflammatory diseases are now at the top of what kills people. And they're working on that. And it is possible that the generation after me, let's say you, Marion, will live to 130.
Oh, God willing, you'll be with us till 130 at least. But I think the key, what you said there, with which I completely agree, is that, of course, growth prevents those kind of zero-sum thinking and zero-sum game. Growth allows all of us to move forward. A perfect example of that, taking it back to Fleming, is that Fleming allows us to have a population of 8 billion people who are every year getting richer. So that ipso facto tells you that there isn't such a thing as a fixed pie of wealth.
Or a limit to growth.
Or limit to growth.
So we
are getting richer, and that, of course, provides... And growth is not just providing medicines, you know, those terrific pharma companies all around the world producing stuff that we all need, but also more and better food available at cheap prices, housing, etc.
iPhones, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, again, Matt Ridley, he talks about the iPhone and he says, look at what you've got on there. You've got your entire music collection. You've got a compass. You've got it just on and on and on. And that's economic growth.
Yeah.
And human happiness.
Yeah, precisely. But I also think that in addition to, people sometimes say, you know, we had all of this growth in technology and science, but we didn't have enough moral growth. But I disagree with that, because I think that in addition to having all those additional years of life, which in itself is a moral thing, the fact that you no longer have to bury your child before the age of one, that's a moral thing. I wonder what you think about it, is that also rich countries, meaning countries with a lot of economic growth, tend to be very good on such moral issues, such as position of women in society, treating gays and lesbians with respect, being good to their ethnic minorities, being religiously tolerant. All those things are very highly correlated with growth, wouldn't you agree?
Well, they're probably very highly correlated with wealth, in as much as when you've got a basic standard of wealth, they say that human happiness doesn't increase after you earn $10,000 a year, but it increases rapidly up to that stage. So let's say everybody could earn $10,000 a year, then there'll be very much less need for prejudice in the world to blame anybody, because you're not so unhappy and you're not looking around to somebody to blame for your unhappiness.
Actually, John, there is a new research on this that shows that happiness keeps on increasing with income, even into millions, which is something that people have been only researching for the last 10 years or so. But that's very encouraging.
I was going on a 20-year-old book, that Stumbling on Happiness book by the Harvard guy. I'm probably out of date. I have to say, the richer I get, the happier I am.
that's very good. You have already mentioned you have taken us through that process of enrichment. You know, moving from horse-drawn carriages to steam power to electricity, etc. But tell me more about the sort of institutional underpinnings of growth. Why does growth happen in terms of what else do you need in a society?
Well, I've written this book that you've kindly been nice about in two volumes, and the first volume is out already, and the second volume is out in January. And the first volume talks about the three big things that you've got to have for growth, and the second volume I'll mention briefly in a minute. But the three big things are small government, low level of taxes, and a low level of regulation. And if you look over and over again, there's study after study. I just went into this saying, well, okay, what creates growth? I didn't have a particular point of view, and then I discovered that everybody said is three things: small government, low level of taxes, low level of regulation. And I looked through all these academic studies, and they're absolutely dispositive. There's no doubt that that's what you need. The problem is that you've got a nasty little thing called Wagner's Law. Wagner was Adolf Wagner, in about 1865, in a small German university, said in a democracy, the size of government inexorably increases. And what he really meant was that in order to get elected, politicians promised the world to the electorate, and they sometimes even deliver that, and delivering it is expensive. I think it was Mencken who said that a democracy is where you vote for you for what you want and you get it good and hard.
Right.
But politicians have to promise, you know, new things to get elected, and when they get elected, it costs more, so the size of government goes up. Because the size of government goes up, they have to tax more, and that, you know, leads to big state, big tax, social democracy. This is what the European Union is testing the limits of right now. France is up to a government that's about 55% of GDP and taxes of about 50% of GDP, which of course creates a significant deficit. Germany the same, and they're not growing at all. They don't have any economic growth. 20 years ago, our government was about one third of GDP, and now it's at 45%. So you can come up with theoretical but very valid reasons as to why that's going to cut growth into ribbons. But in any event, in the last 2 decades, our growth has more or less stalled. Real wages in our country are about 5% lower than they were 17 years ago.
That's shocking.
And if you looked at the European Union, the Wagner's Law says, you know, it's like whatever that story is about how you get poor. You get poor slowly for a long time, and then suddenly. The European Union is getting poor rather suddenly at the moment. But around the turn of the century, GDP per capita was about the same as the US. You've got to do purchasing power parity and all that, so you can have different arguments. But let's say about the same. Now it's, you know, what, 25% lower, because America has kept on growing and the European Union has kept on not growing. And the whole battle, as I see it, if you get rid of the ideological culture wars or whatever, the big battle I see as between the Conservatives and Labour in the UK and the Republicans and Democrats in the US is whether you want to become like the European Union or not. And I think the Obama-Biden project, bless them, was to turn the United States into the European Union with a whole dash of all sorts of other problems like culture wars and immigration and so forth. But that was the basic problem. And the battle in the UK has been whether we manage to become more like America, which would lead to a lot more economic growth, or a lot more like the EU, which would lead to much less economic growth. And so far, even though Brexit has meant that we've left the even though we've left the EU, we're still becoming more and more like them. We're growing. This latest government we've just had has massively increased the size of government, and also they're attempting to increase the size of taxes. My book says, actually, that won't happen. Art Laffer's been very nice about this book, and I admire him tremendously. And in a rather cheeky way, I've gone beyond the Laffer curve to something I have egocentrically called the Moyni curve. Laffer curve says it goes up and it goes down.
This is the tax revenue taken by the government, meaning you reach a percentage at which you actually take less tax revenue.
Right. I say that actually the amount of tax that a country can take from its people is invariant. However much it tries, it can't go up a certain flat level. And that level in the UK is about 36%. And
John, forgive me. Let me interrupt here. But the level is different. The level is different at different countries, how much taxes you can
correct.
Take. Okay, keep going.
And I'll get to that in a minute. But in the UK, it's 36%. And Labour has published its economic plan last week that says we're going to raise tax rates, and that will increase tax revenues to 38% of GDP. And I've been writing about this for the last dozen years or so. And every year I say there's another government that comes along seeking to raise more taxes. And I say, no, it's 36%. And if, by the way, if GDP isn't growing, then tax revenues won't grow. And I said this last year when the Conservatives raised taxes. I said, you can raise tax rates, but you won't raise more tax revenues. It'll stay at 36%. And it did. And as a result, of course, they spent more because of Wagner's law, but they didn't raise more. So the deficit in the UK now is 4.5%, even before Labour come in. And Labour actually, I mean, in boring numbers, which will not mean a lot to your listeners, Labour said we're going to spend £70 billion more, although actually, they're going to spend even more than that because there's various things they say they're not. It's not spend; it's investment.
Sure, of course,
but anyway, they say £70 billion, and they say they're going to raise another £30 billion of taxes. So they've increased the deficit by £40 billion. I can't remember what the hell that is. That's about I think 1.75% of GDP. So it goes from 4.5%, and you add that bit. But I'm saying, well, you won't raise that £32 billion of taxes because you're assuming you're going to get 38% out. But the Moyni curve says it's flat. Now let me explain why the Moyni curve works. And of course, I owe all this to Art Laffer, who's a genius. And I just riffed off him. But you look at all the different countries. Interestingly, the Scandinavian countries have quite a high level. They can raise 48, 49, 50% of GDP in taxes from their people. So can France. Singapore can only raise, 16, 18%. Now, Singapore believes in low taxes, so you can always raise less by cutting tax rates like mad. Everybody will gratefully accept that. But Singapore is that low. The UK is very low. I'm trying to think of somebody who's at about 40%. Damn it. I was just looking at somebody the other day who's about 40%. But there'll be countries around the world about 40%. The US is significantly lower. Why would they be different? Well, you may have heard, Marianne, about this psychologist called Hofstadter. And he spent all his life trying to distinguish national characteristics. And he came up with, descriptions of what you were on this measure, what you were on that measure. One of the measures he takes is, how risk-loving is that nation? And the French are very risk-averse, interestingly. The Brits are very risk-loving. So are the Irish, by the way, and the Irish can't raise much tax either, but they don't care because they've got some wonderful tax fiddles where Apple passes all its revenues through Ireland and they get a lot of money that way. The Brits and the Irish are very risk-loving, but they are also very independent. They're not very collectivist, whereas Nordic Scandinavian countries are much more collectivist. The French were enormously collectivist. Remember, liberté, égalité, solidarity. Solidarity between us all. We all believe in the mother state. And so, well, I'm wondering how long that's going to last. But anyway, so if you take Hofstadter's measures of each country, you get a brilliant correlation between what the level of their Moyni curve is. And it is a massive correlation. It's in the book. And
I think I've got it. I didn't know we were going to go there, but that's very interesting. This would be page 321. Culture drives the tax hike, right?
There you are. And your viewers can see that there's a line there. Unbelievable. Just this guy Hofstede, who I think he was Dutch, I'm not sure. And I just put a couple of his measures as against the Moyni curve number, and there it was.
Yeah, but basically, this says that this is revenue, government revenue, going from high to low, and this is risk taking, being high at the one end and low at the other end. So less taking equals more redistribution. More risk taking equals less redistribution. So that's very interesting. So I think that economists are becoming much more interested in culture than they used to before. It used to be all about institutions, but it's more about the culture. But I want to sort of sum up what you were saying just a little bit before moving on to other questions. So you talked about Wagner's law. That's a well-known law whereby the richer the country gets, the more countries spend on social welfare. And usually people on the economic left see that as a sign of progress. It means that the wealthier you get, you know, the more socially conscious you get, better care you take of poor people, etc. But what you seem to be implying is that at some point, the Wagner's law has to reach some uppermost limit, mostly determined perhaps by culture, about how much money you can take from people and redistribute. And right now, what's happening, I think I surmised from what you said, is that the Wagner's law continues to demand from governments to produce more, but they can only raise so much taxes, so the rest goes yes. to borrowing. Tell us about
yes. Well, that's your deficit. And so if Britain's deficit was 4.5% in the last year and will be 5.5% or 6% next year, that's the percent of GDP that they have to borrow. And then you add that borrowing on top of the existing national debt. You've got the UK and indeed the US. I mean, the US has gone absolutely mad, both under Trump and under Biden, in terms of the wasteful and squanderous way they are borrowing and spending. There's, if you remember, the US was chided for having what's called the exorbitant privilege, where they were the world's reserve currency, so they could just borrow as much as they like. But that won't last forever. So, but the whole way that borrowing comes about is a totally different story. You know, Biden's extraordinarily named Inflation Reduction Act and so forth. Where was I going with that? Sooner or later, and of course my book's about the UK, it's not about the US. I'm sure somebody's going to write this book about the US. Sooner or later, your debt to GDP gets to such a level that investors are not very keen on buying any more of your debt or even of holding it, because they worry about you going bust. Now, everybody thinks Britain can't go bust, you know. But Venezuela was the richest country in Latin America for forever. And it was a wonderful, you know, it was a brilliant economy. And so forth. And now it's,
in 1952, Venezuelan GDP per capita was higher than the United States. Just FYI. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Now, of course, they did have a lot of oil, but it doesn't matter why. What matters is they were tremendously rich. And I'm sure they've defaulted on their debt by now, haven't they? I don't actually know. But well, let's take Argentina as another example. In 1910, I think, it was the 10th richest nation in the world. It's an extraordinarily blessed country with wonderful beef and agriculture and so forth. And weirdly, they have, I think, the highest IQs in South America because they've got Italian genes. And the Italians have one of the highest IQs in Europe.
I didn't know that. Yeah,
I just happened to bump into that knowledge. But anyway, 10th richest country in the world, and then they discovered Peronism, which is the acme of Wagner's law, and then, you know, by the turn of this century, they were regularly defaulting on their debt and constantly having to go to the IMF for debt restructuring and the like. So there's a couple of examples of rich, prosperous, well-run countries that went to hell. And Britain could easily go to hell. France could easily go to hell. At some point, you can't go on borrowing. Now, you remember there was the Reinhardt-Rogoff result. Do you remember that? That said that you can't, your debt to GDP can't go above 90%, or you are on an inexorable path to doom. Now, the embarrassment was that some graduate student checked their Excel spreadsheet and discovered a fundamental flaw in it, which was cue for slight embarrassment on these Harvard professors. But everybody thought that, that there was anyway probably a lot of truth to that whole idea. If it's not 90%, I mean, we're at 101% now, I think, and we're going to keep going up. So I was going to say that Labour just redefined our debt. They said we're going to be paid student loans back in the future. So that's money we're going to get. So let's lower our debt by that amount. Of course, they didn't add in the future liabilities, which would actually more than double our national debt to over 200%.
I'm aware of the Rogoff Reinhardt controversy. My understanding is that the flaw, which was found in the paper, did not hugely affect the findings. But I want to explore with you what are the mechanics by which such high debt has an impact on economic prospect? Is it because it's crowding out private investment, because interest rates have to be so high in order to make people buy more debt that businesses basically cannot afford that interest rate?
The crowding out, I think, more refers to the size of government. So when government's half the economy, it's crowding out human enterprise, private enterprise. But there's some very straightforward maths as to why a high level of debt doesn't work. Right now, the UK economy is coming up to £3 trillion. That's, you know, nearly $4 trillion. The debt is about 100% of that. So you have to pay interest on that. Let's say you pay I can tell you what the interest cost was last year. I think it was £116 billion. I don't know what it turns that is in percent, because we managed to get some nice long-term debt at low rates over the past couple of decades. That's one thing Britain did do well. But all of that, now that rates have gone back to more normal levels, that'll all become bigger in the future as the cheap debt matures and has to be replaced by more expensive debt. But £116 billion, our whole government expenditure is about, I've momentarily forgotten, but it's north of £1 trillion, a little bit north of £1 trillion, and 116 billion of that is 10% of the state budget. So if you had no debt at all, you'd have another 116 billion pounds, like $150 billion, to spend on things, on your population of 70 million people. And a lot of your troubles would go away. All the things, you know, you'd be able to build new hospitals and all that sort of thing. But you can't. You've got to pay that money to people who hold your debt. And then as you add more debt, you've got to pay more of it. So bit by bit, your entire national budget is getting to be more and more debt repayment rather than doing things for your population. And at the same time, your population wants more and more. So you're in the most terrible shape. And then at some point, as your economy fails to grow, you're not able to afford that money. And then if you can't afford it, people start worrying about you paying back that debt. And so the rates that you're paying go up and you're in this doom loop. And sooner or later, you have to call in the IMF to bail you out.
That's right. But for our listeners, what I want them to walk away with is to understand why, if government spends more money, you have less growth. And I want to show them what I think is one of the... In fact, this is why I got in touch with you originally, because this is the chart that everybody should be aware of and everybody should see. Basically on this axis, you have increased government spending as a percentage of GDP. And here you have different growth rates. Basically, the
vertical axis is the growth rate, and the bars are different categories of government. On the left, you've got government, and I'm just making this number up, say government that's spends less than 25% of GDP. And over on the right, you've got government that spends 50 and 60% of GDP. So you can see on the right that those high spending governments have very low growth. And it's absolutely dispositive. And I first produced that chart in 2012. I stole it from somebody else. Nothing that I say in the book is original. And I've been redoing that calculation year after year with new data and all sorts of different data. And you always get the same result.
It's super impressive. So what it says is that if the government spends less than 25% of GDP, it grows on average by 6.6% a year, which is amazing. It's almost 7%. So you double your GDP per capita every 10 years. But countries which spend over 60% of GDP the government spends over 60% of GDP grow only at 1.6%. That's 5%, 5 percentage points less.
But don't forget that if you're only growing at 1.6% and your population is growing at 1%, then your GDP per capita is hardly growing at all.
Right.
And it's GDP per capita that's actually the really important measure. Now, you've just shown the facts that if you have small government, you grow a lot. And if you have large government, you don't. And that's why the richest countries in the world right now are Switzerland and Singapore, who are now considerably wealthier even than the United States because they keep their government really small. Now, of course, if Elon Musk succeeds with his DOGE, the Department of Government Expenditure...
Efficiency, sorry.
Then America will be back into growth again too. So that will be interesting. But it doesn't say why. Why does that happen? And I give a number of different reasons. And one of them is this crowding out thing. Another is I appeal to people's common sense. Let's say you've got three governments, one of which has the size of government is 20% of GDP. Second, the size of government is 33% of GDP, and the second, the size of government is 50% of GDP. And all these governments exist, massive, lots of examples throughout the world of each. Now, if you're growing at 20, if the size of government is 20% of GDP, then for every one government worker or beneficiary, somebody either being paid by the government or being given benefits by the government, there are four private sector people paying for that one person, because that's the four of the 80 and the one is the 20%, right? Now, increase the size of government to 33%. For every one government employee or beneficiary, there are two, because there's 66% over here and 33% over here. Now go to the government where there is government 50% of GDP. For every one employee or beneficiary, that has to be carried on the back of one private sector worker, and it becomes a crushing burden.
But that's a different way of saying that it's the private sector which creates the wealth that can be spent by the government. So if the government is spending 50% of GDP, that means that only 50% of the economic activity in the country are being conducted on the principles of free market economics, with profit incentives, etc. Whereas 50% is basically government, what the left would call investment, but we would basically call taxation and spending. So yes, based on what you said, it basically means that in a 50% government spending economy, you have one government worker being dependent on one private sector worker to create the wealth which the government worker has to spend.
And you touched upon the fact that the public sector is going to be way less productive. Productivity in the public sector in the UK is way below what it was 15 years ago. In other words, what each employee produces. And yet we've massively grown our public sector. The number of civil servants goes up every week after week, for the past, 20 years. And amazingly, this new Labour government has said, we're looking at letting every public sector worker go to 4 days a week. Now, if you like me ran private sector companies for years, you would have gone bust if you'd done that.
It seems to me that the Labour Party, the top echelons of the Labour Party, don't know how wealth is created. Am I wrong?
Not a single member of the Labour cabinet ever worked in the private sector.
That's an extraordinary statistic.
Absolutely astounding. I'm an equal opportunity critic, because the Conservative government that preceded them was no better, really. And arguably, it's the civil servants who are running the economy now. Sitting in the House of Lords, I see the same bills coming through now from the Labour government that were coming through before the election from the Conservative government. No, not much. Well, the Labour government making them even worse, but they were pretty bad before, and it's the same bill. So, there's so many angles to why a large public sector makes it impossible to grow. Now, I'll give you another example. If you can bear me for me to go back to the Moynihan, because again, that's just a theoretical idea, right? 36% can't raise more taxes than that. Well, why not? Well, you look at the UK, because we're more risk taking. Now, income tax, 30% of all income tax in the UK is paid for by the top 1% of taxpayers. 60% of all income tax is paid by the top 10% of taxpayers. Going down to the bottom 54% of citizens get more money from the government than they pay in income tax. So they don't care. They actually quite like a large government, because if you have a smaller government, they may, some of them may drop out of that. But what matters is that top 10% who produce all the taxes are the entrepreneurial types. They're not necessarily rich people, but they're the people who will bust a gut to build a business. They're young, high achievers. They are millionaires and billionaires and rich people who want to have an environment where they can invest their money and not have it confiscated. And it's the risk-taking behavior of that top 10% that determines what the level of your Moynihan curve is. It's not the risk-taking behavior of the entire population. And right now, we have an absolute flood of millionaires leaving the country. We have an absolute flood of young high achievers in their 20s and high earners leaving the country. And we are the only country in Europe with a net outflow of millionaires. And it's not just a few of them. It's an awful lot of them, and it's the richer ones. I mean, I know plenty. I tell you, a couple of funny anecdotes. Well, one anecdote is a friend of mine runs a very high-end club, and he's lost 700 members this year. Now, Now, those members, they have four houses around the world. They're all very rich. And moving their domicile or resident, tax residence, whatever, it's just a matter of just getting up and going off and living in their house in Italy or whatever, or in Dubai or wherever.
Or the United States will take them.
Well, a lot of our millionaires are moving, and a lot of our young high achievers are moving to America. I moved to America when I was 26 and lived in America for 20 years because I was fed up with, you know, the whole environment here in terms of the economy. But the point is that we are the only country in Europe that's losing millionaires right now. Every other one, they're going up each year. And that's how raising taxes, having a larger state that requires you to raise taxes, results in people leaving, which means that you don't raise the tax anyway.
Yeah. I wanted to make a couple of points. One is you talked about labor and conservatives, and you know we are a completely non-partisan podcast. So you're like you, we are equal opportunity critics. And as you quickly pointed out, what's happening with labor was really, I mean, partly it's a result of the fact that for 14 years conservatives have done really very little in order to juice the economy. The second thing which I wanted to point out, which I think is very important, is that it's part of that risk-taking mindset that allows you to build an economy. It's part of that risk-taking mindset that you are willing to pack your bags and leave to another country. And this is something that politicians very often don't understand. The same kind of person who is able to create a big successful company is also the kind of person who is not going to be kept behind by sentimental links in a country which is bleeding them dry, and they're going to try their luck somewhere else. And you know that's where you end up where you did. But as we sort of close, we have about 10 more minutes, so I don't want to impress on your time, but I want to ask you, you already mentioned you lived in the United States, presumably you left Britain when Britain was doing very poorly in the 1970s. And now we are going back in that direction. What happened? Is it that we have... is it that there is a new generation and people forgot about Britain in the 1970s? Is it that nobody had explained what happened in the 1970s to the British people and so they don't remember it? Is it that intelligentsia has brainwashed the British people into believing that everything was hunky-dory in the 1970s and Thatcher was really the problem? What happened that you are back to square one?
It does look like you have to teach every generation the perils of socialism. We had a debate last night on a new law that they're bringing in to have a regulator for football. Now, by football, I mean soccer rather than American football. But it is the most absurd thing. And by the way, this regulator will have a requirement on all football clubs to have an EDI strategy. That's equality, diversity, and inclusion. And by equality, they mean equality of outcome. And we had the debate last night in the Lords, and I spoke, and anybody wanting to hear what I have to say can waste 8 minutes looking at a tweet I'll put out showing it quite soon. What I said in there is because, by the way, regulation is probably even worse. We haven't really touched on it. Even worse than large state and high taxes. And there is an attitude in the UK now of, well, here's a problem. So something must be done about this problem. You know, it might be, I mean, a prime minister 6 years ago created a minister for loneliness.
Extraordinary.
That would be in your verbiage, that would be a department for loneliness. And as I say in my book, a minister for loneliness, why only one? but so any problem, something must be done. The government must be involved. There ought to be a law. There should be a regulator. And so bit by bit, the entire economy of the UK is gumming up so that because a regulator has required this, that, or the other requirement, thinking, well, you know, I know best. You know, I know best what should be done. And it's the old Hayek, the fatal conceit, which the fatal conceit is that government knows best and that markets don't know best.
I was laughing yesterday. I was listening to PMQs yesterday, and Starmer kept talking about the economy of the future. And I was wondering, how does he know what the economy of the future is going to look like? If he knows, then he should be a multi-billionaire.
Yes. Well, the economy future for them is green jobs, which is one of the most meretricious phrases ever invented, because there's no such thing. It's like, you know, the old Bastiat jobs of people digging holes and filling them up again. This regulator, as I pointed out in my speech, a regulator for soccer, you know, equality, everybody got to have equality. Well, no, it's not equality. I'm sorry. The E is equity, not equality. And equity means equality of outcome. Right? Now, I pointed out soccer is a game. It's a competition. There's a thing in that game called a winner and another one called a loser. That is not equality of outcome. And I said, is this regulator going to require that every game end in a draw? Because the whole idea is lunacy. And yet we've got to that stage. We've got so many regulators. And now we're going to have a regulator for soccer. For example, I was moving some money from one bank account of mine to another a couple of weeks ago. And I was told, well, you can't transfer the money. You've got to write a check. Okay, fine, here's a check. No, you can't send it by mail. You've got to walk it down to the bank, prove who you are, and pay it in. That's only 45 minutes of my time. What could possibly be wrong about just taking a little 45 minutes of my time to walk a check down to the bank? But when you consider that regulators are doing this sort of thing all over, right now they've been trying to build a new railroad in the UK, and there was a regulator who was worried about a colony of bats somewhere near this railroad, and they required that the builder build a sort of roof over 10 kilometers of this railroad, which became known as the bat tunnel. Actually, it was to keep the bats out from, you know, flying in front of a speeding train, and that cost £100 million. That's $130 million, right? To build this, and that's a regulator. And funny enough, it's just come out, this thing, and everybody in the House of Lords has been going, this is dreadful. This is £100 million to build this bat tunnel. How batshit crazy is that? And I said to them last night, you've all been complaining about this bat tunnel, but you're putting in more and more regulators. Who do you think made you build that bat tunnel? It was a regulator you put in. And more and more and more of life is regulated, and more life is just congealing. And until I believe the whole economy is just going to congeal into inactivity. But I may be exaggerating slightly.
When you talked about the three reasons that underpin economic growth, one is rule of law, the other one is low taxes, and the third one is small government. But small government doesn't just mean, from your saying, it doesn't just mean that you spend less money. It also means that you regulate less. This is the key takeaway that I take from what you just said.
Yes.
No, that's absolutely right. Now, let's finish on this. I was struck by something that you said about every generation being just, we are always one generation away from socialism. Do I take it from that? Do you conjecture that that the default setting of a human being is more or less socialist, and that you need to educate them out of it? I mean, if we always come back to the same sort of way of looking at the world, which is regulate more, tax more, give me more, zero sum. That would mean that there is a human nature that we are struggling to overcome, and we have to do a better job at doing that.
Fortunately, I don't think that is the case.
Okay.
And I'll explain that assertion in this way. The very last part of the book is Appendix D. I don't know how it ended up in there, but it's because it would have been overweening to put it in the body of the book, but it's a bit of an obsession of mine. And Appendix D talks about thinkers versus feelers. Now, Mother Nature or God or whoever you wish to believe ordered the way human beings are, so ordained it that half of the world, half of human beings would be feelers and half would be thinkers. And it was Carl Gustav Jung, we're back into psychology now, who defined thinkers from feelers. Feelers are, they act from the heart. It's how they feel about something, what they think their principles are. It's how they are impelled to behave and judge. Thinkers use their head and use logic to get to their answers. And it just so happened that it turns out if you think that natural selection will select the best mix, natural selection selected a mix of 50% feelers, 50% thinkers. Now, the feelers' primary thing is be kind. And the thinkers is be logical. And feelers think that thinkers are pretty bad people, by the way. You're a thinker. I'm a thinker. I come up on the test as an extreme thinker. I mean, obviously, as I get older, I get a few estrogenic hormones circulating around in me to you know, with your grandchildren, things like that. But I'm a thinker, and I can't understand how feelers don't like me, but they don't. And you ask feelers how they feel about thinkers. You ask, are you a mercy person or a justice person? Mercy people are feelers, justice people are thinkers. And everybody knows what you mean when you ask that. And if you say, what do you think I am? And people will say to you, oh, you're a justice person. And you say, am I nice? Now, a feeler will say, no, not really. You're a bit fascistic. You know, you're Ronald Reagan. It's awful. Now here's the problem. Feeler thinker is gender differentiated. 40% of women are thinkers. And so they hate to be thought of as, they don't want anybody saying, oh, all women are feelers, which they aren't. But 60% of women are feelers. 60% of men are thinkers, 40% of men are feelers. The primary schools, children up to the age of 11, are almost exclusively staffed with women across the country right now. And as a result, the be kind philosophy is more inculcated into children than it was 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now children are coming out mostly rather woke. Now, when they leave school, when they're 20, 21, or leave university, you know, they say conservatives is a liberal mug by reality. When they first get a job or whatever, they start thinking a bit differently. But young people now are massively inculcated in the be kind philosophy and are told over and again that you know, they must be kinder, that boys are toxic and boys should learn to behave like girls and so forth. I'm not into some massively anti-woke statement here. I'm just saying factually what is happening. And so everybody believes now that the default thing is to be kind, be nice, and that means be socialist. And I think that's why we've got the problem that you just enunciated, Marion. And I think that a reaction is starting now. And in the next lot of generations, we might see a little bit of an opposite. But it is a problem because right now, young people do not vote for capitalism. They think the capitalism is a horrible thing. They enjoy the fruits of capitalism every second of their ever-loving life. But they don't understand that, and they think that, you know, socialism should exist, except for them, of course, because they all have the same aspirations as you and me, and they want to do tremendously well. But in general, they think that socialism is the way to go.
Yeah, and of course, there can be such a thing as too much compassion, or alternatively, if you want, faux compassion, where you encourage maybe antisocial behaviors, or alternatively, you undermine your society, like its economic growth, by redistributing too much and then killing off the golden goose that, or rather the goose that laid the golden egg. So I'm really glad that you included that in your book. And I must say, of course, I didn't make it to Appendix D. I wouldn't have.
Well, you'll enjoy it. It's a bonne bouche at the end.
So once more, John, I am deeply grateful that you came on the podcast. The book is Return to Growth: How to Fix the Economy. It talks about why growth is important. It talks about what causes growth. It talks about what holds growth back, how you can restart it. And really, it's an excellent guide to the overall structure of the British economy and where to make the kinds of savings that can reduce the size of the British government, and therefore once again launch Britain on a path to growth, just as it did in the late 1970s and early 1980s. So, John, I'm deeply grateful for the hour that you've given us, and I hope that I hope to see you in London in February 2025, when I'll be coming to London for the Jordan Peterson ARC meeting. So,
I look forward very much to seeing you there, Murray.
Thank you very much. All the best.
All the best. Bye-bye.